Hello. I'm aware that the process of isolation in which each of us now lives, which may be highly relative for those who aren't like me actually in solitary confinement, but our isolation from one another and from the work being done, that work called learning, teaching, the modification of a human being's view of the world through communicated vicarious experience and the state of personality of someone else. The isolation in which we conduct that process means that there is only in the written word, in what I read in your journals and what we type to one another on an etherpad, there's only a written word with which to understand emphasis in this dance we are conducting without seeing one another. I will add that seeing one another in the Zoomian sense won't fix that. The nature of human nonverbal communication, as we have occasionally addressed it in the course of trying to build a lawyer's theory of social action, the languages of our bodies and our personal projection from moment to moment are ill captured by what we are pleased to call video conferencing. Facial expression is important if you have a facial expression, if you aren't merely a primary color block and some initials even in the Zoomified universe. But as you will be able to tell if you choose to listen to the United States Supreme Court conducting telephone argument, that process will be enormously different than the process of standing at the lectern in the United States Supreme Court's courtroom trying to understand from posture and facial expression and gesture the ideas of eight justices who happen to be speaking at the moment, or if you're lucky, nine, just as standing in a courtroom and reading a silent and indeed highly socially constrained jury from moment to moment is of crucial importance. Korean people are lucky in having a word in their own language for reading a room and for building an idea of social interaction around it. They may not otherwise be completely fortunate in what the circumstances compel them to do with that sentiment, but at least the understanding of reading a room helps, as it does in figuring out what to do in a law school classroom if we are ever again, any of us, in a law school classroom. So in that world of teaching without reading the room, a world which I believe cannot help but lead to inferior teaching, I have a sense of the rhythm of where we ought to be and what we ought to be doing, which is a kind of a ghost limb, like an amputation still felt in the remainder of the nervous system. In this course, more than in all other courses that I teach, I depend upon reading the room in order to understand which pieces of our puzzle of creativity in law school and in law practice I ought to be at any given moment sliding tentatively towards the front, what to read, how to talk about it, which portions of the emotional responses that we have to what we're reading ought to be most immediately addressed, how to understand the context of whatever the local pizza for free shows may have been during the course of the week, and all of which is absent from what I still feel in some vestigial sense are my judgments about where to take the course. Under other circumstances, in a course about something different than how to become a lawyer, one might have a better program. I know in computers privacy in the Constitution, which parts of the argument at any given moment I am in, and the coherence of what is being taught has to do with the fulfillment of one particular way of thinking about it. But the subject of this course is, or at least I should say used to be, or is supposed to be, the development of 38 people's structure of self-understanding within which they become lawyers. And that's not a process about which one can take a determinist point of view. Nonetheless, from my telephone booth overlooking the Hudson River, in the total seclusion in which I guess about what it is that this course is about right now, I guess that it is more or less urgent to refocus on the question of how to be creative about practice, and to subordinate all the other activities in the conversation, even including law school, about which one can say a number of things about a law school that used to exist, which may never exist again, and certainly will not exist in the usual way for you during your time of passage through it. There is still much that could be said about law school, and I have some idea that if we all continue to operate in this degraded state, which I think is likely for at least another term, we will have to find ways of talking about how to go to law school when you don't go anywhere. But now, both as a consequence of where I tried to push things in the aftermath of John Brown and Martin King, and partly as a consequence of the journal writing and the pad conversations I have been having since, it seems to me now, when a whole lot of the ordinary ways of sort of becoming a lawyer in the second semester of law school, the stuff you would go to and the people you would run into and all the bad socialization that would be going on in relation to, quote, career, quote, services and so on, all of that having essentially ceased, it's a little like that the moment when the tide fully runs out and the ocean disappears before the tsunami comes back, where in this case I do mean, as the great psychotherapist Philip Bromberg says in the title of a book, that the tsunami here is anxiety. The tsunami is the difficulty that we have when the water of reality rushes in upon us in ways that our minds try to deal with by compartmentalizing, only to discover that the compartments fill up and, like the ICUs of one part of the United States after another, they are simply washed into a jumble they cannot understand. This, which I have for the last couple of weeks tried to formulate in a way that I now see is inadequate, I've tried to formulate as the conflict between a flight to safety and the ever greater importance of the job on the one hand, and the value of being the oldest young lawyers in a changed society on the other. But as I experience that form of conceptualizing the situation fails to help to learn what you need to learn, I recognize that it is now time to formulate another way to think about what is happening and to put it at your service the best way we can when the service that we have to offer exists only in this deteriorated, isolated, incommunicative state. It's true that for this purpose I conclude, one needs both profound seriousness and capable satire to deal with the absurdity of the $315 refund is not sufficient, because although it is deeply absurd, it is not broadly absurd enough to capture the nature of the society which all around you is being chopped up and reconstructed, or will be, let us say, reconstructed. Now it is mostly still being run through the macerator. One of the reasons that the extent of the government reformulation of the economy now going on in this very incapable way, as the organs of United States federal government that were previously gridlocked and impeaching and trying and acquitting one another are suddenly spending quantities of money that nobody can quite believe they're spending without really having any fundamental underlying social agreement about why they're doing it or how it should be done. One of the reasons that this jumble is going on is that it's hard to stop an economy dead and put it on life support. But the other reason is that it was frail to start with. Oh, we didn't think it was frail. The Dow was very high. The president was booming on about nonsense all the time. The rich were getting richer. But the frailty of the society was such that roughly half of American households could not meet an unanticipated $500 expense. And while consumer debt had taken something of a backseat in the overall indebtedness of the economy to just masses of semi-doubtful corporate borrowing as the smart money went out and borrowed even smarter money at low interest rates. Student loans, as you well know, were nonetheless becoming an overwhelming part of the overall debt profile of the economy. And as they did so, they were reflecting limitations on individuals' futures. The apparent overall strength of the social system, burdened slightly by what was known as inequality, a subject that actually was, you know, only relatively late pursued, as it were, in the country into which I was born, the top 0.1% of the holders of wealth in the society owned a staggering total of almost a tenth, about 7% of all the wealth. But of course, in my lifetime, we reached a world in which the top 10th of 1% of the owners of all the wealth owned almost 40% of all the wealth of the United States. The top 1% owned more than half. We became an aristocracy in that sense within one lifetime, namely mine. And one of the consequences of the structure of that aristocracy, in which its highly educated servants became the other beneficiaries of redistribution. One of the consequences was that debt acquired in the course of gaining an education for the purpose of becoming the servants of the aristocracy, who were themselves the other parties entitled to a growing share of income and wealth, the debts acquired in the course of that process became another drag, like the real estate mortgage, on people's futures. And while, at least in relatively liquid times, the real estate mortgage can be, you know, repaid out of the sale in a rising market, the student loan debt, which burdens the futures of young people, can only be paid back through the incomes of the borrowers. There's really just no place to go and liquidate the equity all at once until we get to the point where, you know, technological transfer of knowledge directly from one brain to another allows the rich to buy the knowledge of the poor cheap, a process which is being pioneered by the parasite with the mind of God, the thing we call Google, Facebook, Twitter, and so on. But what that system of indebtedness in return for the ability to serve, that really requires a little bit of satirization. And it's true that at this moment, feeling the urgency of attending more than before with the tightest possible focus on the question of how one should think creatively about becoming a lawyer at this time, I do find that I have one last, you know, piece of reading left in the bag that needs doing, and it is Thorsten Veblen. There's no doubt about it. Veblen isn't, in by primary self-identification, of course, a satirist. Right? I mean, he's a profoundly serious university intellectual, an economist and sociologist, whose writing, let us say, is not naturally funny. H.L. Mencken, who didn't like him, said that except for Warren Harding, he wrote the worst prose that it had ever been Mencken's displeasure to read. That was, I think, a biliousness about a competitor, a world in which H.L. Mencken and Thorsten Veblen are competitors is not the world in which Rush Limbaugh and Donald John Trump would have two-hour radio programs listened to by millions, I should say. But Veblen's seriousness of purpose and his seriousness of execution are coupled to a position in which the pursuit of satire is inevitable. Then, by which I mean in the last quarter of the 19th century and the first quarter of the 20th, the Gilded Age and the Progressive Era, as the taglines would go in an American history course, like now, to be critical of capitalism is to be forced, in a way, to satire, because mere description takes on that quality, and anything partially trenchant becomes immediately vicious. It is our two eras of unconstrained greed and the indifference of the very, very rich to the meaning of their wealth, which generates that inevitable descent into satiric bitterness for anybody engaged in ambitious, serious, critical description. That it is primarily Veblen's intention to engage in serious, high description to say that of all those who have ever tried to cope with the three great ideas of the 19th century, the ones we call Darwin, the one we call Freud, and the one we call Marx, Thorstein Veblen is as deep and powerful a thinker as you can get, attempting in the most effective way to understand the intersection between the idea we call Darwin and the idea we call Marx, and the theory of the leisure class, which is the initial and strongest, most memorable version of that undertaking, was published in 1899, the year that the book by Sigmund Freud called The Interpretation of Dreams created the idea we call Freud for the first time. So Veblen's intellectual project is as grand as you can get, and it is pursued enormously successfully. The contemporary academic economists will award to Thorstein Veblen a founding role in the creation of institutional economics, a disposition of thought in which they still believe, and they will do so relentlessly, ignoring the fact that his criticism of capitalism is not, as they like to say, non-Marxist, but on the contrary, entirely Marxist, just not socialist, not politically Marxist. And nobody will deny what maybe only John Kenneth Galbraith had the literary self-confidence to do. Nobody will deny, though few will proclaim, as Galbraith did, that Veblen is actually the founder of an entire alternative school of economic thinking, as well as of the relationship between technical and institutional factors in the construction of economic life, for which the existing reputable profession is willing to remember him. His first effort to become an American academic ended with his first doctoral degree at Yale in 1884, the year that Richard Parker was dying in the dinghy of the Mignonette. But he was unable, despite a distinguished academic record and a PhD thesis we think was pretty good, though it was stolen from Yale in 1935 and no human being has seen it since, he was unable to secure academic employment, whether because of prejudice against Norwegians, as is suggested by a couple of writers, or as a result of prejudice against atheists, of which he was undoubtedly a little too obviously one, or for whatever other reason it may have been, and thus it languished for 11 years after his PhD without a job, returning to his Midwestern roots among the Norwegian farmers of Wisconsin and Minnesota, where, as Helen Tharrow says, you know, he became a primitive. Her associate's statement that Cousin Thorstein is a primitive is, of course, itself a joke, based on the way in which Veblen uses words like primitive and invidious and so on, as well as a literal objection to the nature of his analysis by a Wall Street guy. Wall Street guys do think that Thorstein Veblen is primitive, you understand. That's necessary. It's a dissociation that's required in order to retain sanity. Veblen's subsequent reinvention at the University of Chicago and his attempt to teach both there, which is where he was teaching in a junior dead-end role when The Theory of the Leisure Class was published in 1899, or subsequently at Stanford, came all apart. He just wasn't a respectable fellow. His feminism, as you will have noticed, is both rather strong and also entirely compatible with a relatively high state of misogyny. His belief in the broad requirement in social life of the emancipation of women included a general tendency to believe that having sexual affairs with the wives of his colleagues was good for almost all parties, which caused some difficulty and made him academically difficult to promote. He, like Charles Beard, who had been deprived of academic employment at Columbia University for opposition to the First World War, and other dissident academics, formed the New School for Social Research in New York City in the 20s. Veblen was associated with its faculty, among its earliest faculty, when he died in 1929. And the New School then became a home for scholars exiled from fascist Europe. So in his own career, Veblen is both a man standing deeply in his own light and also recurrently exiled for his critical relationship to the pieties of existence of one or another kind. This makes a satirist, there's no doubt. There's a reason you get sent to an empty part of the Black Sea to hang out with barbarians. It happens to those who displease not just the emperor, but the theories of the empire. But Veblen's primary task in the theory of the leisure class, or in the theory of business enterprise, or in the higher learning in America, Veblen's primary task, as he understands it, isn't to make fun of or to deprecate by invidious comparison the nature of capitalist institutions. Veblen's project, as he understands it, is to create an evolutionary theory of economic life. What he takes from the idea we call Darwin is the core of the idea we call Darwin, that there is random variation in phenomena that one studies in an evolutionary science, that things change in random and undirected ways through processes of variation that are themselves exogenous to the study, and that a selective pressure, a differentially operating upon all of that undirected variation, over time produces the evolved outcomes that we see around us, and that the history of the phenomenon, their change over time, whether it is the history of life on Earth or the history of economic institutions, practices, and structures, designs, the history of economic institutional phenomena, like the history of life, can be understood in terms of selection pressures applied to random underlying variation in order to produce highly organized and complex outcomes. From the point of view of the project as an intellectual activity, then, the goal is to explain what selective pressure it is, to which, when applied to all the underlying variation of the phenomena, whether biological or economic, produces what we see and accords with the evidence that we have of the change over time, whether that is the fossil record of the life on Earth, or whether that is in this peculiar and, one might say, unscientific form, his anthropological history of human cultures. The idea that is Darwin that is represented by all the work from the on the origin of species through the evolution of emotions in man and animals, that the idea at the center of Darwin is that the selective pressure applied is that of natural selection, that is to say, differential survival over time. The absence of a mechanism for explaining variation, which in The Descent of Man, Darwin tries to give mechanics to in the form of breeding, so that the questions of selective pressure in reproduction can be brought to a sufficiently technical outcome that one subform, that is sexual selection, choice in mating, can be applied and can be shown to be the form of natural selection that has been dominant in the evolution of the human species. That attempt to find the technical basis of natural selection failed Darwin because he didn't have the advantage of what we came to call Mendelian genetics, the combination of which with the theory of speciation by natural selection in the mid-20th century came to be called the neo-Darwinian synthesis. But Veblen doesn't need a form of genetics in order to explain underlying variation in economic institutions. He has instead some theory of what human beings are like, and whether his theory of what human beings are like is the same as ours will affect how we understand the source of variation in culture. But as to the selective pressure, as to what it is that determines which institutional variations differentially survive in economic life, as to that, Veblen has a clearer grasp even than Darwin. It is that institutions economically survive which aid pecuniary competition, or in the earlier pre-pecuniary stages of society, as he visualizes them, which aid another form of invidious emulation, that is, the attempt competitively to be more wealthy or more powerful in economic or material terms than other individuals. This, simply this, gives rise to the economic form of the psychological proposition of emulative competitive conduct as the root of what determines whether economic institutions survive. From an economic point of view, then that same selective pressure can be defined narrowly as waste. Now, of course, by the time one has come to the conclusion that the differential survival of economic institutions is based upon their propensity to waste, one does now exist in the realm of satire. That is to say, that if scientifically this is the proposition you mean to pursue, if this is the hypothesis around which you organize the evidence you acquire and the experiments you design and conduct, then you're in the satire business, because this is in ironic confrontation with everything that people engaged in the activity you are studying believe. Intrinsically, therefore, whatever you say, to the extent that you're analytically successful at all, you are saying in the key of satire, you are ironically confronting the society's perception or the individual's or the institution's perception of themselves. That's what satire does. Hence, it is the case that whether with or without the irony that all of the biographical material and the nature of the writing itself would suggest, even if we thought that it was all unintentional, Thorsten Veblen is as subtle and as slapstick a satirist as you can find in A Long Day's Walk, because, of course, the whole hypothesis of the capitalist's dream of himself as the master of the industrial world, and all of the pieces that Thorsten Veblen wishes to point out as coming from the non-peaceable, barbarian, pre-industrial state, all of that rhetoric, in the end, confronts the fact that what the capitalist believes is that efficiency is why his brutality is legitimate. The transformative force applied to the material, and here Veblen, like Marx, is clear that the material of slaves is different from the material of coal mines. Not from an ideological point of view, you understand, but from a psychological point of view. The nature of the capitalist's claim to the acceptability of what he, she, it, and they do, well, you know, because you can't go to law school without being indoctrinated in the proposition of allocative efficiency, and its presence all around us and the wonderfulness of the decisions that it makes for us. The premise of all of this is that we are putting things to their highest and best uses, and that market institutions are the way that we ensure that that occurs. And it is, after all, Veblen's in point that what actually determines whether things survive as competitors for alternative economic structures and institutional arrangements is that they survive to the extent that they are good at wasting. The fact that in some structure over historic time, the primary element of waste goes from the waste of labor to the waste of consumption, from the mere presence of supernumeraries who must eat but don't contribute to the making of what they eat, on the one hand, to the point at which it is the consumption of goods produced by workers for others toiling in a supposedly efficient way somewhere else. This is, from Veblen's point of view, quite rightly, only a secondary phenomenon. Whether a tribal arrangement generates a potlatch or a capitalist arrangement generates Trump-owned golf club golf resorts doesn't matter. Whether the thing consists in the large number of household troops in uniform stationed around the White House or the private security guards at a General Motors building, or whether it is the cars and the planes and the boats and the jewelry, is secondary to the phenomenon that really matters, which is that over time, and everything from the design of the tools we eat with to the nature of the houses we live in, to the nature of the clothing that we wear or the people that we dispose as retinue around us, the fact of wastefulness will be what ultimately causes the attraction that we have to products and institutions. That's the primary motive understanding. And it is, well, at ironic loggerheads with everything that we otherwise will say, that the demand curve generally for almost everything slopes downwards is, from Veblen's point of view, neither true nor anything but accidental where it's true. For the fundamental point, of course, is that things are often demanded in inverse relationship to their cheapness and utility. At the present moment, we are aware of that with respect to all sorts of things which we ordinarily don't take for their wastefulness as symbols in our lives, but of which we are now directly aware of the extent of waste implicit in everything we do. Without the restaurant industry, we discover something about how it is that we waste food. And of course, once we are locked down and the natural world begins to respond to the absence of the pollutants we are constantly emitting, we begin to understand the importance of the wastefulness of the petroculture. The requirement that primates do business with one another by looking in one another's eyes is an important subject, which in a longer semester actually involved in seeing one another from time to time, we might have talked about a little bit. Does lawyers like Wiley and his partner, who are constantly engaged in meetings, why are there meetings? Well, we discovered that, among other reasons, there are meetings is so people can wastefully travel around. It isn't that they think of the point as wasting all the petrochemicals that are burned in order to move us from one place to another, but that nonetheless we discover that our attraction to those institutions of the meetings and the business travel and all the rest, that like Veblen would have expressed to us, hinges in substantial measure on our investments in waste. And people are learning to think about the professional class work clothing differently too in that respect, no doubt. Their dry cleaning bills have suddenly gone down after all, and they don't have, at least if they're not the President of the United States, quite as much reason to continue to purchase lots of long red ties. And that begins to affect an understanding about the ways in which, as Veblen is, of course, quick to point out, the ceremonial and wasteful qualities of the ways in which we perform law are really important to our understanding of law. And without the wasteful formalities and the wigs and gowns of whichever sort our wigs and gowns may be, without them, we used to feel, and soon, as we are allowed to go back to our ordinary lives in this respect, we will feel again, without the wasteful formalities, there's something. Well, you know, I mean, Columbia University is mourning its inability to have commencement far more than it's mourning its the need to charge you full tuition for not quite full education. As Veblen points out, the nature of that dependence upon formalities, the caps and the gowns and the commencements and the speakers and the deep dependence of the university upon those rituals for its sense of its self is at odds with the ease with which it believes that it can, quote, move its courses online, close quote, and continue to be just as good and worth just as much as it was before. Now, it's very sensitive to modifications of its ritual elements, but whether it is equally sensitive to the outcome of changes in its technical elements, well, and once again, there's Veblen to say. Now, under ordinary circumstances, or at any rate in what I think of as ordinary circumstances, at this moment, there would still be a great deal of Veblen to talk about. We're really only scratching the surface here, and there are many pieces, including, as I say, what we might think of as the pioneering version of misogynist feminism to consider. But I can't. I mean, I can. It's easy enough, as you know. I've taught Thorsten Veblen in many different ways over many decades in different contexts, and there's a hell of a lot of value in it. But really, what now is most important for me is to return that to the context of the question of how does Martha Tharo become the lawyer that she is, and who might you be becoming? Of course, partly this is to point out how much the culture of the job is really around the culture of the waste, right? The large metropolitan law firm of the late 20th century, which has slid off its precipice, or maybe that was a pedestal, I'm not sure, into becoming what you all refer to as big law. The large metropolitan law firm in the United States in the 20th century was a pecuniary competitor of precisely the kind that Veblen has in mind. Its offices, its privileges, its perks, its partners' bathrooms, its, you know, its skyscraper views, and also its billing practices were wasteful. And deliberately so, not in the sense that the partners who built those institutions were themselves aware of waste as a goal, but rather, as Veblen would say, because that's how the institutions were differentially bred to survive. The large metropolitan law firm is the outgrowth of the large multi-state industrial and commercial entities that grew up after the railroad revolution and are the fruit of the Gilded Age. The law firms that represented entities in, say, New York with continental interests became the one-stop shop for figuring out how to organize legal activity, including litigation and defense, across an entire continental scheme. They were the ones closest to the clients, and they were the ones organizing the depth of legal activity that such clients, for the first time in the history of our law or anybody's law, had to be prepared for. And so, in the era of the telephone and the typewriter, not yet in the era of the jet plane and the fax machine, they grew large as the intermediaries to a financial system located in New York, and a commercial system spread like the railroad economy across the continent. Not yet was Washington, D.C. a central piece of that growth and understanding. Not, that is, until the expansion of the federal government's role in the national economy and the growth of expert administration in the middle 20th century brought about. But these institutions lavished wastefully upon themselves to prove their strength to one another and to their clients. And their forms of practice, including the Napoleonic scale of their litigation and the nature of their expensive discovery practices and the forms of staffing that they used in the execution of corporate finance transactions, all of that had as a very important element its wastefulness that only the powerful could afford. And so, of course, with the standards of pecuniary reputability among the lawyers. When, on the first day of the Nixon administration, January 22, 1969, the United States Justice Department amended the complaint in U.S. against IBM to double the size of the massive litigation it was then proposing to conduct against IBM, which wisely hired as general counsel the former Attorney General of the United States in the previous administration. When that happened, Tom Barr of Cravath, who was the outside lawyer conducting the litigation in U.S. against IBM and in 12 other private antitrust actions that were about to be filed against IBM in the aftermath of the government's move, Tom tripled the salary that Cravath was offering to first-year associates in order to assure the supply of bodies he would need for the conduct of such litigation. Cravath in 1969 raised the first-year wages of associates from $5,000 to $15,000 a year in New York City, and in doing so basically brought about the massive overflow of fees into the pockets of young lawyers at the law firms, which created the dream now dying in which you are still the last inoculated victims, that this is the way to start a career in law because the training is so good and the money is so excellent. It would, in a different year, at a different time, be useful to read Lewis Auchincloss's wonderful stories of Tower, Tilney, and Webb in the period before that happened. Someday you should come to powers of attorney one way or another. It would be useful to think about how that particular era in the shaping of large law practice that followed from Cravath's breakout move in 69 affected the way that law school, particularly, I don't know, law schools on Manhattan Island, behaved. But for now, it is sufficient to say that there was a great upswing in the form and breadth of the conspicuous consumption, the ability to identify in the institutions of law practice in New York City a particular certain kind of money poisoning, and therewith the opening of an abyss, apparently unbridgeable, not in reality, but in the minds of young law students, an abyss between what can be done or achieved or at any rate, I don't know, gotten by working in a large law practice and what can be achieved or done or gotten by working in a practice of your own. In other words, not terribly surprisingly, in a way, the wastefulness became industrial, organized around an army of labor, in which the waste was a kind of collective guarantee of the power of the practice, but also an introduction to an idea of how to lead a life in the law, which wasn't a life in the law, just a life in the firm. And of course, for a whole variety of reasons, from Veblen's point of view, what follows is, you know, a superlatively wasteful, including of the human beings involved, for whom leisure, well, never mind, and consumption, but of course, and not to mention, as both Thorsten Veblen and Martha Tharoux would be quick to point out, an awful lot of women leaving the profession and how many of them winding up actually running the law firms. And all of this, as you understand, over the last, you know, quarter, third, 40% of a century, that is to say roughly the amount of time that I have been talking to second semester students at Columbia Law School. Over the decades in which I have been working as a teacher and people like you have been working as students, the values of those institutions became unquestionable. They were simply the common sense of the world, and everything outside it was, as Veblen would be quick to say, disreputable in the truest sense. We could say now it will be different, and to some extent it will. Veblen died in 1929, a couple of months before the stock market crashed, and all of what he'd ever had to say about the value of engineers as opposed to businessmen in industrial enterprise and government was at least tried in the course of the 2 decades following his death in a way that he had never been tried before, and for which he is not regarded, unlike, say, Felix Frankfurter, as a major creator. Though the oldest young people in the world of the New Deal were precisely those who, as undergraduates, came to read and appreciate Thorsten Veblen, even if H.L. Mencken didn't. The criticisms of capitalism that Veblen offered, which are as Marxist as you could want to get, including, of course, the crucial issue of the use of a sociology of class, right? Yes, Marx's interests are in a confined set of classes defined by the history of European societies between roughly 1000 and roughly the day after tomorrow. But Veblen's highly Marxist, in the sense of class-structured, historically materialist sociologies of political development, Veblen's highly Marxist ideas about the problems of capitalism and technology, they are pretty much guaranteed now to turn up any time that anybody has any moments of doubt or uncertainty about the virtues of globalization and the economy it wrought. Whether you will hear Veblen dismissed as a primitive or forgotten altogether, in law school there's never been quite as much Thorsten Veblen in my teaching life as I would have expected there to be. But no matter how much the importance of his thought in generating these ideas is overlooked, the ideas themselves are now. You couldn't possibly think current coronavirus era economic and political criticism. You couldn't possibly imagine The Guardian without Veblen. Right, I mean, the Extinction Rebellion without Veblen, veganism. I mean, in so many different ways, after all, what has come to be understood by a significant, not numerically preponderant or politically overwhelming, but a significant fraction of the human race is that our institutions and practices have been marked primarily by waste, now on a planetary scale. And that this is, in a way, an inbuilt problem in society which cannot be fixed with coal scrubbers, which, from Veblen's point of view, is exactly right. It's not a technical problem. It's an ideological problem to some significant extent, Veblen would say, in the dichotomy between technology and commerce and business. That this is industry, not technology, doing this work, and that the institutions are the problem rather than the technologies themselves, all of that also has a place in the thinking of the 21st century at what we are pleased to think of as the progressive end, as though this too were ideology 100 years old, and the use of the word progressive in that context is in some sense, once again, a sort of effort to reach his point. But we, for the moment, as I say, are in another place altogether. I think it's somehow inadequate to talk about these things in those terms. And instead, I feel once again, the overwhelming requirement to come back to where we actually are. The wastefulness that underlies the institutional structures you call big law, that wastefulness is always now frailly at risk in the overall weakness of finance capitalism in this highly inequitable form. If this is going to turn out to be a commercial depression, a financial crisis, a global reorganization of the economy, these entities you call big law are too inflexible and too wasteful to survive without fundamental restructure. That this is likely their case, that they are indeed in this sense unfitted for the medium term, was already suggested by the outcome of the crisis of 2008, which everybody now understands was substantially smaller by maybe an order of magnitude, certainly by multiples, than this present crisis is. In the same way that I had no reason to regret not being a Cravath partner in 2007 because of 2008, when my mother asked me on my 50th birthday, did I ever regret not having been there, I certainly don't regret not being a Cravath partner now. You can see why it is desirable to imagine, even if you don't execute, self-sufficiency in the 21st century economy. You can see why to be able to be economically self-sufficient in life, to be able to cover the nut profitably with something left over to grow upon, doing work you consider meaningful and controlling your own time, is at least a desirable outcome. Maybe not the only desirable outcome, maybe not the most desirable outcome. Maybe you would still rather be a partner at Gibson Dunn than to have the practice of your own choosing in the place you'd most like to live in the United States, doing a balance of things which in the end are both meaningful and profitable to you. Maybe you really would prefer the other. It is in many respects simpler to imagine. I will take a job and then I will get promoted a couple of times and then I will be rich. That's a lot easier to imagine than I will make the thing that expresses who I am and that allows me to prosper and enjoy my life in my own way. Of course, that's harder to think about. And so in the last pad hour, when I ask people to imagine the details of such a life, naturally, everybody either falls silent or begins to return to generalities like, I wish to help the helpless and home the homeless. And yeah, right. That's what we want. We want professional lives that reflect our values. The question, exactly how? What will I do all day? How will I make my money? Where will my clients come from? How will I balance all these things so that I get what I want and I don't have a problem sending my kids to college? How will I get home for dinner? These things look hard and are hard in some respects, right? Not because they're hard to do, but because they're hard to imagine, but because committing oneself to the idea of getting them is way more work than imagining, I will get $700,000 a year out of my partnership, and then I'll spend it. And if one takes seriously the overwhelming commitment in our economic institutions to waste, if one takes that seriously as against an idea of economic life called sustainability, now quarreling at the corners with big capitalism, but never actually getting a chance to bring itself to reality, because sustainability may get invited to Davos, but it doesn't actually show up at, you know, board meetings. So if we are in some broad sense constrained by our history of industrial exploitation, man over nature, conquering the continent, bridging the continent with rails of steel. If we're a little too guided by that in the post-petroleum period for what we call sustainability, which is essentially not melting the planet and destroying a shit ton of all the rest of the living things. If we're constrained in some way by our histories of wastefulness in all our economic institutions, well, you know, like pandemic preparedness, that means that we are late getting to the point, but that doesn't mean we can't get there a little bit. The best time to plant an oak tree was 30 years ago, but the second best time is today. And that, after all, is, you know, I mean, if we really wanted to have a just society, we should have changed law school 30 years ago. But if we want eventually to have a just society, we could change law school today. And similarly with the question of how lives in the law should be lived, the general tendency towards nostalgia, we hold commencement and people with good suits and excellent taste show up, and they drink with the dean, and they hobnob with you, and we have champagne and strawberries, and everybody understands that, you know, we are joining the ruling class. It won't happen. Oh, God, we feel so bad about that. But maybe we shouldn't. Possibly, after all, one of the things that's happening to us in our clarity right now is that we're understanding that the shows and formulas of the wastefulness of the leisure class in our legal education are not the thing we need to regret losing. Maybe indeed vast structures in which a tiny portion of the society gets its legal work done by very wasteful objects located in marble paneled buildings with partners' bathrooms give way a little bit to lives in the law that are prosperous in every way. You get, if not the McMansion, at least the house you want, and you have a thing to drive that you don't consider disreputably old or inadequately German, and you have wonderful technology of entertainment and education, and your children go to expensive schools where there's actual human teachers engaged in really teaching in classrooms, which will surely become very expensive once we have fixed the healthcare system. All of this available in ways which restore to you a life more genuinely not wasteful. Not wasteful of your time, not wasteful of your energy, engaged in making meaning and making money, both in quantities that you can balance for yourselves. The critique of capitalism may be right about capitalism, but it's even more important if it's right about your life. For that, in the age of the pandemic, for that, it should be clear there can be no glory whatever in wasting. Talk to you soon.